Okay, folks, welcome back. And I just wanted to get started about 30 seconds early. Are there any questions before we start? Because, you know, the class is quickly winding down. We have only three more sessions left, two this week and on Monday. Your final project is due Monday. You need to put the numbers into that Google Shared spreadsheet, I hope by Sunday. And your final exam is a week from Friday. So everything's kind of winding down. So any questions before we start? I will send you some material for the final exam, the review session, the webcast, you know, links to past finals. But remember again, this final exam will be multiple choice, unlike previous final exams, but it'll be structured the same way. The questions will look the same. So let's go back to where we were on, no questions? So let's go back to where we left off on Wednesday. We were talking about acquisitions and how, for the most part, they've been a loser's game. Losers for who game, in what sense? Well, acquiring company shareholders never seem to get any spoils from all these acquisitions. The target company shareholders seem to walk away with all of the upside. We were talking about, you know, some of the rules. Don't use the acquiring company's risk to assess the target company's value. So when you think about betas and cost of equity, they always have to come from the target company. Second, we said don't reward a target company for the fact that you have access to debt at a really low rate. It doesn't belong to them. Pay them it to a premium. But we ended Wednesday's class talking about synergy. And I hope I kind of laid down, I think, the basics of synergy, which is if a synergy to have value, you got to tell me where it shows up, higher growth, lower cost. And then I'm going to do the dirty work of estimating the cash flows, the risk, and coming up with the value for synergy. But you need to value synergy because you need to be negotiating as the acquiring company for a portion of that synergy. You can't pay it all in a premium. So don't let it become a buzzword, which is what it's become in a lot of acquisitions. Why are you doing this acquisition? Synergy. How much is it worth? I don't know, but it's worth a lot. That's not good enough. If you're going to pay for synergy, you have to go through the process of valuing synergy. Any questions on synergy before we move on? Because it can take so many different forms, right? It can be operating, it can be financial, but ultimately it has to show up in the cash flows, the discount rate for fair value. Okay, so let's move on to the next piece of the acquisition puzzle. So I've been trying all these different ways to get you to pay more. First, I tried to get you to use your cost of equity and you said no. Then I said, why don't you just fund it with debt? So you have really cheap debt. And you said no. Then I should throw synergy at you. And you say, okay, I value it and pay that much, but not much more. But I'm trying to get you to pay a higher price. So I hit you with a couple of bankers use, they want the deal to go through. So I come to you as an acquirer and say, look, I know you've been doing this DCF stuff, but nobody uses DCF in acquisitions. We base it on what people are willing to pay. And I tell you that other acquirers are paying 5x that. And I show you this table called a transaction multiple table. What is it? It shows you transactions, acquisitions that have happened in the last few years and what people are paying. So I said, look, the target firm has 20 million in operating income. Companies typically pay 5x EBIT. So would you be willing to pay 100 million for the acquisition? What's the answer to that? Anybody? What am I doing here? First, am I doing a valuation or a pricing when I do this? I'm doing a pricing. And in a sense, you're buying this company for the long term. So already you're using the wrong tool because you're buying this company as a business to make a part of your company. You should be using a pricing. See, you say, no, I don't do pricing. They say, what if I use 5x EBIT on your terminal value? It's still a pricing, right? It's a forward pricing. And finally, because you're getting so stubborn, I said, you know what? This is a good acquisition. You know why it's a good acquisition? It's accretive. You know what accretive means in an acquisition? Anybody want to give me a working definition of what an accretive acquisition is? You might have heard the terms accretive and dilutive. What does accretive mean? Anybody? What is an accretive deal? your earnings per share goes up. Exactly. So basically I'm saying, and you can see the leap of faith, and your earnings per share goes up and your PE ratio is 20, then you will see your price go up. So basically the arguments used to justify acquisitions is, first, everybody else is paying these multiples, and the second, the deal is accretive. Let's see how meaningless both those claims are. First, let's start with transaction multiples. I know when we talked about pricing, I said there's nothing wrong with pricing. So, okay, so let's say you want to do an acquisition, you have to do pricing. But if you're going to do pricing, I said, you want to make sure you don't bias your numbers. But when you pick those comparables, you want to make sure you get a full spectrum and control for differences. The problem with using transaction multiples is you have a biased sample. You see where the bias comes from? What do we say people do on acquisitions? They tend to overpay. So if I look at a sample of transaction multiples, I can almost guarantee that you're going to overpay for your target company because you've taken a biased sample, a sample of people who've already overpaid. The problem with pricing with transaction multiples is you've mispriced your target company. So even if you want to do pricing, do it right. What does that mean? Look at the entire sample, not just at acquiring companies, and look at what people are paying. Control for differences. And you have to make sure that the pricing then is a fair pricing, not a biased pricing. You say, what about this accretive dilutive stuff? If I had my brothers, I would ban the words accretive and dilutive from an M&A language because it's completely meaningless. Can I do a bad deal that's accretive? Absolutely. Can I do a good deal that's dilutive? Absolutely. Accretion and dilution have almost no correlation with whether a deal is good or bad. And here's why. If I'm a company with a PE ratio of 20 and I buy a company with a PE ratio of 10, almost by definition, the deal is going to be accretive because I'm buying a lower PE ratio company. You see, so what? Why was the company, the target company's PE ratio so low? Because it had a higher risk or lower growth. After I acquire the target company, neither of those problems are going to go away. You know what's going to happen to my combined company's PE after the acquisition? It's not going to stay at 20. It's going to drop to 18 or 16 or 15. So people almost seem to assume that markets are stupid, that they will leave the PE ratio at what it is and give you a higher price, but that's not the case. So transaction multiples and accretion dilution, neither should be used, but they get used all the time. Any questions on the words accretion dilution and transaction multiples? Now I hit you with the biggest sales pitch. Because until now you're resistant, right? You're refusing to pay more and I'm throwing you all these inducements. So I say, look, your CEO really, really, really wants to get this deal through. Why? Whatever reason. He wants to build an empire. Now, you just need to justify the pricing because he's going to do it anyway. It's a pretty tough argument to go against, right? You're saying, I'm going to do the right thing. Well, you could lose your job. The bottom line is many companies, the decision to make an acquisition comes from the top down. You know, one of the things studies have found is when you look at acquisitive companies, serial acquirers, you know what they share in common? CEOs who seem to go from company to company, and these CEOs tend to be acquiring CEOs, and wherever they go, they bring that practice in. Ego drives decisions more than numbers or analysis. So one of the things you'll be told is the top management wants this deal to go through. Why are you slowing us down? And here's the other, and Dave, I think, mentioned this last class, is what if you're in a sector where if you don't acquire a company, somebody else will? In other words, you're asked to do a defensive acquisition. See, if you don't do this, somebody else will, and then you'll really be taken to the cleaners. So let's take those arguments apart. First is when you're looking position, it is absolutely true that if you step into a deal saying, I want to win this deal, you will, because all you have to do is pay more than everybody else. In auctions, this is called the winner's curse. You know what the winner's curse is? You go to an auction and you win. You should always have mixed feelings. You won, but why did you win? Because you paid more than everybody else in the room thought that that item was worth. The same thing is true in acquisitions. If you go and say, I want to win this bidding war, you will win. But the consequences will be only negative for your stockholders because you're paying more than everybody else. As for defensive acquisitions, I think they're a bad idea. Why? Because if the only way you can stay afloat is by doing acquisitions and overpaying for them, because if you don't, somebody else will, you're almost by definition in a bad business. You should think about shrinking and perhaps even going away. I'll give you my perfect example of a defensive acquisition. When Walmart bought Flipkart, for those of you not familiar, Flipkart is this growing online Indian retailer, which is an abysmally run business. The guys who set it up had no idea how to run a business, but they knew how to grow. So Walmart bought Flipkart for $21 billion. I call it the most expensive facelift in history. Why? Because Walmart wanted to be young again. But you know why Walmart bought Flipkart? Because Amazon egged them on. Amazon let out this rumor that they were interested in Flipkart. And the minute Walmart heard that Amazon was interested, they went out and kept bidding and bidding and bidding. And Amazon was perfectly happy letting them dig their own grave. So when you see defensive acquisitions, you've got to ask the question, is this a business I want to try to expand in? Because often that defensive acquisition is not going to be the last one you do, and you're going to continue to acquire your way all the way into a demolition. Because basically, this is a bad business and there's no way out. Dave asked, was Instagram a defensive acquisition? No, nobody else was interested in Instagram when Facebook bought it. Facebook bought it because it felt that Instagram belonged in their ecosystem. In hindsight, it worked out. In fact, when Facebook bought Instagram, Instagram had no revenues, no earnings, no cash flows. Facebook bought a technology that they thought they could use. And in hindsight, it was the right thing to do. Because without Instagram, think of what Facebook would look like today. Okay. Any questions? Go ahead, Dave.
I have a question about transaction multiples. If a company didn't use, like the acquiring company refused to use transaction multiples, then why would the target company ever agree to be acquired? Like the CEO of the target company would just be like, well, regardless of what you think in the past, this is what companies have paid. And so you should follow, like, why would the target company agree to be acquired if there's a record of previous transactions, which use a transaction multiple?
What did I say was your strongest weapon as an acquirer? When you walk to a bargaining table, what should you be willing to do if you want to make sure the acquisition process stays sensible? You should be willing to walk away from that table. Okay. You know what? If the target company CEO says, look, unless you pay me 20 times EBITDA, which is what everybody else is paying, I'm not selling, just get up and walk away from the table. If he has other bidders who are willing to pay 20 times, let him sell it. Because in a sense, you want your competitors to overpay. It's just going to ruin them. Think of how many companies have been ruined by doing big acquisitions. So I don't disagree with you. Maybe you will not be able to do deals. In which case, you've saved yourself your stockholders a ton of money. Move on. There are better ways to build businesses than doing acquisitions. Nobody has to do acquisitions. No. If you're doing acquisitions, it has to be because it's a better way of growing than with internal investments. So you want to make sure that the pricing you pay reflects what you're willing to pay, not what the target company thinks they should be paying. So I'm not disagreeing with you. I'm just saying sometimes the best thing to do is walk away from a deal. Any other questions? So let me illustrate how bad deals get made and then they get justified and how they get unmade. About 15 years ago, HP bought this British company called Autonomy. Autonomy was a business software services company, lots of promise. HP went out and bought the company, paying a premium of about $5.2 billion over the market price. They almost paid 100% premium. So there's the market price. There's the amount that HP paid, $11.1 billion. And at the time they did this, they actually had to go through a process, which is pretty much what you go through in every acquisition process. And this is what happens when you do an acquisition of a target company is right after the acquisition, you have what's called purchase price allocation. Sounds fancy, right? But here's what happens. A bunch of accountants descend on your company. They reassess your book value and they move things around and magically they push up your book value. So this is a process that Deloitte does, KPMG does. They come in, they do the assessment, they assess the value. So they take the 2.1 billion and they add another 2.5 billion saying, we've looked at your assets, they're not priced right, we've readjusted the numbers. So it's fair value accounting. But even with the fair value accounting, they get 4.6 billion. So it's kind of a cosmetic exercise. Nobody really cares. The market value is 5.9 billion and HP paid 11.1 billion. And they justified it based on synergy. They said, there's a lot of synergy in this deal. We're going to do it. So right after the deal, HP CEO, a guy called Leo Pothaker, who should never have been CEO of a lemonade stand, let alone the CEO of HP, showed up at the sell-side equity research analyst conference in New York, and everybody was pushing because everybody else at the time, HP did this deal, thought they paid too much. So they're pushing and saying, how come you paid so much? It looks like you paid. And he said, and this is what Leo Pothaker said, and I'm going to use exactly his words because I don't want to be accused of putting words in his mouth. He said, we have a pretty rigorous process inside HP that we follow for all our acquisitions, which is a D.C.F based model. I don't think this guy has ever done a DCF, but that's what he called it, DCF based model. Whatever the base model means, I have no idea. He said, in reference to discounted cash flow valuation, a standard valuation methodology. And we tried to take a very conservative view. He should have just stopped here because he kept going. He said, just to make sure everybody understands, autonomy will be on day one, accretive, that's a magic word, to HP. Just take it from us. We did the analysis at great length, in great detail, and we feel we paid a very fair price for autonomy and it'll give a great, this guy loves the word great, great return to our shareholders. And this is right after the deal got done. 2 years later, HP had to unwind the deal. Leo Pothaker lost his job. New CEO is in place. So they unwind the deal. And here's what made it such a stunning unwinding. They took a write-off of 8.3 billion. You know, remember they paid 11.1 billion? They took a write-off at 8.8 billion. So how do you write off 8.8 billion in 2 years? They said they made a mistake. And they blamed autonomy for it. They said autonomy cooked their books. We overpaid because we trusted the accountant. So when they did this, when they reported this mistake, I decided to assign blame. I said, you make an $8.8 billion mistake. Somebody's got to be held responsible. I'm going to hold people responsible for who was responsible for what happened. So here's the first thing I did. I first started by taking the portion of the VAT, the synergy never showed up. So I went back to the original forecast and they forecasted growth and lower costs. So $4.5 billion, I said, you got to blame Leo Pothaker for it because he said there was going to be synergy. And if there's a secondary culprit there, it's all those investment bankers who pumped out those numbers. But it's the prime responsibility lies with the CEO of HP that claimed they could lose synergy. So about $4.5 billion, I said, is there four? It is true that the accountants at Autonomy, which is Deloitte was the Autonomy's accountants, had also played fast and loose with the numbers. I took their numbers and I said, it looks like they did some deceptive stuff. And I estimated that that deceptive stuff cost another $2.4 billion. So $4.5 billion is HP's fault, $2.4 billion is Deloitte and Autonomy's managers' fault. 1.9 billion had to be the HP's management after the deal because they really screwed up autonomy. They took a company and made it worse. And I said, they're responsible for it. And HP's auditors are secondary culprits. I proposed in my post, and it's actually on my blog, that everybody, you know, be held responsible, that the deal makers return their fees, that Leo Pothaker return all the amounts he got paid as a CEO, that Deloitte returned their auditing fees. Essentially, I said, this is what should happen. Then I pointed out to what actually happened. You know how many of these groups are actually held responsible for this mistake? Not one. And this to me is at the core of why so many acquisitions fail. Every acquisition failure, I keep looking for somebody to be held responsible, but nobody seems to be held responsible. So if there's a problem here, it's that there is no accountability. Big deals have lots of people claiming credit. I did that deal, but the deal falls apart. Everybody seems to scurry away and nobody wants to be held responsible. So it, I think, goes back to the core. You know, when you looked at the start of the session, I talked about how many acquisitions fail and what I thought was wrong with the process. One of the things I think that is wrong with the process is so many deals fall apart and so few people seem to be responsible. Which brings me to the final test. And here I'm going to give you at least, if this has been a pretty hopeless session in terms of acquisitions, right? Basically, I'm saying acquisitions don't make sense, don't do them. I'll give you a ray of hope because some of you will end up working in M&A and you're saying, what the heck am I going to get doing? So Dave, you asked, how does the CEO get paid for an acquisition? He doesn't get directly paid for an acquisition, but the company gets bigger, right? CEO's motives are not just how much money do I make? It's also how big is the company I'm running and building empires? All kinds of motives kick in. And sometimes you might have compensation contracts that are tied to revenues or operating income where doing acquisitions can push you above those targets. But it's not so much monetary, I think, as much as I'm the ruler of a much bigger empire. Which brings me to the final question, where is your chance of success? So let's say you're an acquiring company, you're dead set on doing acquisitions, and I want to give you some good advice. So I'm going to give you some choices, and I want you to tell me where my odds are better of creating value. On average, acquisitions don't, but given a choice, would you rather be a sole bidder on an acquisition or try or be part of a bidding war? Sole bidder or bidding war? This is an easy one. Which one do you think delivers more value? I agree, sold better, because in bidding war, it's like being on eBay. If you're the only person bidding, you're much more likely to get a better target. Would you rather go after a public target or a private target? You know what I mean by private target? Public target is a publicly traded company. Private target is a privately held business. Connor, you said private. You're right. Tell me why. What is it about a private company that makes your chances of success greater?
There's less publicly available information on them, so you're more likely to get a better deal on the acquisition, at least my opinion.
You're onto it, but there's actually something else with a public company that makes acquisitions so much more deadly. The private company, how do you decide what to pay? You value the company and then you estimate a premium, right? With a public company, almost by the way it's structured, what do you have to do? You have to pay a premium, not on your estimated value, but on the market price. It makes your job a lot more difficult, right? Because who knows what's built into the market price? So private versus public, you're much more likely to create value in private companies. And I'll tell you another source of that. Bill points it out. Bill, can you unmute yourself and tell me what you talked about diversification. Tell me how diversification is working for you when you buy private businesses. What is the advantage you're exploiting?
So basically you have a, you're exposed, you're less exposed to the, you have a lower beta essentially.
You have a market beta and the other guy is using a total beta, right? Remember the contrast we got with the restaurant? So your chances of paying a premium where both sides walk away thinking they won is greater with a private business. So we'll come back and see whether the evidence backs it up. Now comes a tricky one. You're going to do acquisitions. Would you rather pay with cash or pay with stock? Which is more likely to create value for you and why? Cash or stock? Tim, you said depends. You're right. Tell me why it depends on what it depends on.
As the acquirer, I would want to use cash if I think that my stock is fairly priced. But if I think that my stock is undervalued, I would rather pay with my stocks.
Let me back up. Would you want to do it if it's undervalued or overvalued?
If my stock is overvalued, I would want to.
You see why? Does everybody get it? So it says, you're right. If, it's just, if your stock is fairly valued, then we can talk about which one to use. But if your stock is overvalued, you're paying with, in a sense, overpriced currency. So paying with stock might actually make sense. We'll look and see whether how this plays out in acquisitions. Would you rather go after small targets or large targets? You know what I mean by small targets? You're a $1 billion company. Do you want to go after another $1 billion company, or your odds better if you go after 30 or $50 million companies? Small, and I think there's actually a math reason for it. Even small synergies then between the two companies can translate into big percentage increases in value. Mergers of equals are much more difficult to pull off. Final question, cost synergies or growth synergies? Which synergies do you think are easier to create value from? You're absolutely right, it's cost synergies. Let's see if the evidence backs us up. First, let's see whether you'd rather be a sole bidder or in a bidding war. This is actually a very interesting study. It's an old study, 2011. And what these researchers looked at is what happens to acquiring companies that are sole bidders, or actually in a bidding war. What happens to the winner of a bidding war versus the losers? Because remember, in a bidding war, four or five companies are trying to buy the same company. One wins and the other loses. And the next day, the Wall Street Journal, there's a headline that says XYZ company wins bidding wars. So in this study, they looked at winners and losers. And don't look at the top left-hand corner. One of these, so basically the way to read this is if you look at a graph that's going up, the stock is, going up. So time zero is the time of the actual deal being done. And the period after that, if your graph goes up, it means your stock is doing well. If it goes down, your stock is doing bad. So guess which one of these lines is the winner? Look up at the top, actually, I'm gonna let you cheat. There's the winners. That's what happens to winners. Winners on average see their stock prices go down by about 25%. This is after winning a bidding war. Look at losers. They're branded as losers after the deal, but guess what? Their stock price actually increases. If you're the shareholder in an acquiring company that gets into a bidding war, here's what I'd like you to do. Get down on your knees and say, please God, let them lose this bidding war. Because winning often means paying such a high price that in the weeks, months afterwards, your stock price only collapses. If my advice to companies, if you're in a bidding war, drop out right away. Don't even get involved. There is nothing good that can come from winning a bidding war. So that's the first step. But think of how we classify success. Who does the Wall Street Journal call the winner? The winner of the bidding war. Laura asks, what do you think about acquisitions for talent? Sure, you talked about Disney and Pixar, but let's face it, talent often is in private businesses. So when you look at the Googles and the Facebooks of the world, most of their acquisitions are small private businesses with very talented individuals. Disney, when it bought Pixar, was buying talent, but it was also buying synergy, which is Disney has done a much better job. Much as I love Steve Jobs and what he did at Pixar with Pixar than Pixar could have done on their own. So Disney-Pixar, I think you can talk about real synergies. And it was a merger on equals, right? Disney was a $120 billion company. Pixar was $6 billion. Disney's most successful acquisitions in the last 10 years have been Pixar, they've been Marvel, they've been Lucasfilms. Its worst acquisition? My view has been Fox. I think time is only going to make it look even worse. Goes to small deals versus big deals, and I have no problem looking at buying a small company with a very talented individual, but make sure if you're doing it for an individual that you can lock that person into the main company after the acquisition is done. I've seen acquisitions where a big company swoops in and buys a small technology company because it's got really talented software engineers. And the day after they acquire the company, they come in and everybody's fled because they don't want to work for the big giant. So you've got to be careful about how you structure the deal and make sure you keep the data. No. Any other questions? Okay. Dave asked, are there examples of successful mergers and equals? I'll send you some links. There have been few, but they're always the exception. When I see one, I say, look, that was uncommon. To see. I'll be quite honest, I've never seen a merger of equals when the equals are $50, $100 billion companies. Merger of equals maybe of $10 billion companies, maybe you can pull it off. But usually it's cost-saving mergers then, horizontal mergers. And there have been cases of companies that have been successful with mergers of equals for cost savings. But that's a very specific type of merger. So now let's talk about, would you buy small rather than large? I have some very interesting results in this table. So there are two things I've listed here. One is where, how small the acquisition is. So basically, less than 6%, less than 5%, 5 to 10, 10 to 20, more than 20%. Where I'm measuring how big the target firm is relative to the acquiring firm. The higher this number, the bigger the target firm. So let's look across all mergers and then let's break them down. If you look across all mergers, the smallest mergers create more value than the largest. It's almost, there's almost no contest. But there's an interesting contrast between cash and stock. When you have all cash deals, you see it's more likely that bigger deals go through. When you have all stock deals, it's more likely that small deals make sense. You think, what's going on here? Hey, remember what Tim mentioned, if your stock is overpriced, you try to use the stock. But there's a signal you send, right? When you tell a target company, I'm going to use my shares to pay for you, the signal you're sending target company shareholders is you think your share is overpriced. There's no secret here. So guess what they do? They increase the price they demand from you in return. So it's kind of a game theory almost, where you think you're paying with this overpriced security, and they think you're paying with an overpriced security, so they keep pushing the premium up. And maybe in big deals, the net effect turns out to be negative of using stock, because the target company shareholders so push up the premium they demand that it wipes out whatever benefit you got from using overpriced stock. But in general, small deals do much better than big deals. When you look at private versus public companies, you find what you'd predict. Public, so take the green, so basically we'll come back to the green for later. But take the red and the blue. The red is private targets, the blue is public targets. Across the board, every single kind of deal, public targets do much worse than private targets. You see, what's the green? This is the bonus. Sometimes public companies sell off pieces of their business. I heard Boeing wants to sell its aerospace business. GE was trying to sell portions of its business. So basically, companies selling off a subsidiary. Some of the best acquisitions in history have come from public companies selling off pieces of themselves. You see what's different about those pieces as opposed to public company? First, you don't have a market price out there that you're beating, right? So there's no market price plus problem. Here's the second. When do public companies sell off divisions? When they're doing well or doing badly? Usually when they're doing badly, and usually it's right after a new CEO comes in. So you know what the new CEO does? He wants to admit to the old guy's mistakes. He says, sell this, sell that. At what price? It doesn't matter. Just sell it at any price. I mean, I do Tata Motors in my Applied Corporate Finance class, and Tata Motors is a fascinating company. And for those of you who have tracked Indian automobiles, Tata Motors has really not done well in India relative to other Indian auto manufacturers or even people, you know, who export cars to India. But what saved Tata Motors was a decision they made in 2009 when they acquired Jaguar Land Rover at a bargain basement price. You know who they acquired it from? Ford. Ford sold Jaguar Land Rover for basically a fraction of what they should have, because they just so wanted to get out of this transaction that they were willing to just give the company away. So if you're going to do acquisitions, try for private targets, but also look at subsidiaries, especially large companies that want to get rid of the subsidiaries quickly. In fact, look for a new CEO coming and say, well, do you want to get that bad guy off your hands and just offer to buy it off? You'd be amazed at what prices you can get on those deals. Which brings me to growth synergies versus cost synergies. A few years ago, McKinsey actually looked at mergers after they happened to see what percentage of cost synergies and growth synergies got delivered. So if you look at the two tables, you can contrast them. There are the cost synergies. There were 92 companies that announced that they were going to save costs after the merger. 36 of the 92 actually cut costs more than they estimated. 61 got close to 100%. So if you look at cost synergies, 61 of the 92 delivered either what they promised or more. You look at growth synergies, about 17 out of the 77 actually delivered more than 100%. 13 delivered close to 100%. So collectively about 30 out of the 77. And a lot of companies with growth synergies never delivered any synergy at all. So one of the things that contrasts cost to growth synergies, it seems like companies that promise cost synergies are more likely to deliver them than companies that deliver growth synergies. And I think there's a simple reason for that. When you have a merger driven by cost synergies, you can actually sit down and make a plan. You can say, we have these two companies come together, we have an overlap of distribution centers, we're going to shut down these two distribution centers, and this is how much we're going to save. It's much easier to be concrete about cost synergies. Whereas growth synergies, kind of fuzzy. You know, we're going to grow faster. How much? I really don't know, but we're going to grow faster. And because they're fuzzier, people don't plan for them. So if you think about odds of success, your odds of success and synergies are much more likely to be focused on cost synergies and growth synergies. Synergies that are planned and concrete at the time of the merger are more likely to be delivered than fuzzy synergies. Synergies where you hold somebody accountable for delivering that synergy are more likely to show up than when synergy is nobody's responsibility. And you're more likely to get a share of the synergy gains if you're a sole bidder than if you become part of a bidding war. So again, what I'm saying in a merger is not that synergy doesn't exist, but it's very difficult to claim some of that synergy for yourself unless you're realistic about estimating it. So if I were advising a company that wants to grow through acquisition, let's say you have to be disciplined. You have to be disciplined and say, if you want to buy private businesses and pay well below what they're worth, go out and be disciplined and do just that and know when to stop. My problem with a lot of acquisitive companies is they can be successful for a period, but at some point in time, the success runs out, but they keep going and going and going. And my favorite example is Cisco. Cisco was one of the most amazing success stories of the 1990s. It went from $4 billion in market cap in 91 to $400 billion briefly in 1999 when it became the largest market cap company in the world and did it almost entirely with acquisitions. You see, this is a great case study. In fact, Harvard made a case study of how you can win through acquisitions. And one of the things you should learn is when you become a case study in Harvard, it's almost like you're setting yourself up for failure. Because over the next decade, guess what happened to Cisco's market cap? It went from 400 billion back to 100 billion. And for the next 10 years, Cisco did exactly what it did in the 1990s. It went out and did acquisition after acquisition. It didn't seem to realize that the process was not working. So you need to be disciplined. You need to know when to stop. You need to have plans for both synergy and control before you pay a price for the target company. You need to hold people responsible for delivering those numbers. And if you're in a bidding war, drop out. If you can do that, can you succeed? Yes. And don't tell me that the investment banker told you to do a deal. The investment banker is there to get your deal done. It's not the investment banker's money. It's your shareholders' money. You have to take responsibility for the ultimate decision rather than shunting this off to Goldman Sachs and say, or JP Morgan, or whoever else you called in for advice. So I'm going to close this M&A part by showing you the numbers from a really, really big deal that was done a while back. It was in 2015, when AB InBev, the largest beer company in the world, largest brewer in the world, bought SAB Miller, the second largest brewer in the world. It's amazing that it actually passed antitrust scrutiny. So the thing that made this merger work was, even though this was the largest and the second largest brewers in the world, there was amazingly little overlap between their geographical strengths. InBev was strongest in Latin America and the US. SAB Miller was strongest in Africa and Latin America, but not in Brazil, which was InBev's strongest suit. So by bringing these two companies together, there was talk about synergy, and you could see where the synergy was coming from. One of the problems was SAB Miller owned 58% of Miller Coors, and this deal would have required them to divest themselves by 58%. Otherwise, the antitrust laws would have kicked in. So the motives for the merger were to grow AB and Anheuser-Busch, AB InBev in Africa, and SAB in Latin America, and consolidate. AB InBev was talking a lot about cost cutting, and they actually had some credibility because they were run by a group called 3G Capital. For those of you who never heard of 3G Capital, it's a Brazil-based group which is notorious, well-known for being incredibly cost-cut conscious. And they had a history of doing this. They bought Modelo, Grupo Modelo, the Mexican maker of Corona beer, and they improved the margins by cutting costs in Modelo by almost twice. They increased the margin from 14% to like 26%. So when they said, we're going to do this, we're going to find synergies, we're going to cut costs, I cut them some slack. In fact, Sebastian has said, these same ones that did the craft deal, absolutely. So this was, you know, their reputation was built up in the days leading up. 2015 must have been a bad year because they bought both SAB Miller as the people running InBev, and they also, in conjunction with Warren Buffett, bought Kraft Kraft Heinz, another deal we've talked about. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to take what I just talked about and apply it on a real merger. Talk about how do you value synergy, who's getting the benefits. So let's go to town. Here's the first thing I'm going to do. I'm going to take a look at the acquiring company, AB InBev, and SAP Miller, the target company, as standalone companies. Remember, the first step in valuing synergies, you have to value the companies as standalone companies. Here's what InBev looked like. InBev had an operating margin of 32%, by far the highest margin of any brewer in the world. So that's their 3G capital playing out. They had revenues of 45.8 billion. And then also the rest of the numbers basically reflect. So if you look at the revenue breakdown, they were getting 42% of the revenues in Latin America with a big chunk from Brazil, 36% from North America. That's the AB part of InBev, Anheuser-Busch. If you know the history of Anheuser-Busch, this is in, was it Milwaukee, I think, or St. Louis. It's St. Louis. So it's a Midwest-based company that eventually became part of AB InBev. 11% from Europe. 11% from Asia Pacific. So that's what InBev looks like. I'm going to value InBev separately. That's what SAB Miller looks like. Yeah? It had 22 billion revenues, about half of what AB InBev had. 35% from Latin America with a big chunk from outside Brazil. 31% from Africa. SAB Miller dominates Africa, especially South Africa. Yeah? 19% from Europe, 14% from Asia Pacific. In spite of being the largest and the second largest brewers in the world, they had remarkably little geographic overlap. So when they argued about synergy, it actually made sense. So here's the challenge. SAB Miller's market cap on the day that InBev announced it wanted to acquire SAB Miller was 75 billion. Remember we talked about the challenge in buying public companies, it's market price plus. So 75 billion is already the base. You can't offer less than 75 billion. The deal was completed a month later with InBev agreeing to pay $104 billion for SAB Miller. Let me pause right there. How much of a premium is InBev paying? $29 billion, right? So the question you have to ask is there enough additional value in this merger to justify paying $29 billion? At the time they announced this deal, the market seemed to think so. And you know how you can tell? They added $33 billion in combined market cap to the company. So if you took AB InBev plus SAB Miller the day after the merger was announced, the market seemed to be going along and saying, why is the market so willing to believe AB InBev? I believe that 3G Capital had enough, at least credibility in the market. When they said cut costs, the market said, okay, if you're saying it's worth $29 billion, it must be worth more. A little dangerous, as you can see, because that's exactly what we said about SoftBank and WeWork, right? Masa Son is such a smart guy. If he's paying $47 billion for WeWork, it must be worth more. So here's what I decided to do. I decided to double check. I said, I'm not going to trust the market. I'm not going to trust 3G Capital. I'm going to try to value the company to see what justifies this deal. So broadly speaking, there are three ways you can justify a premium on an acquisition. The first is if the target company is undervalued. Maybe the market made a mistake. This has been the motive for Berkshire Hathaway acquiring companies often is when they believe a company is undervalued, they go out and buy the company. And why do they get away with it? Well, when you're Warren Buffett running a company and he says, I think a company is undervalued, people are more likely to believe it. The second is because you think a company is badly managed and you can run the company differently. In which case, the premium reflects the fact that you think the company could be worth with you running the company. And the third, of course, is synergy. It can be offensive synergy, higher growth, pricing power. It can be defensive, where you're cutting costs, consolidating, or it can be financial synergy. So I left the plate open and said, let me look at what the synergy could be here. And here's the process by which I'm going to value synergy here. There is the acquisition price. We know it's $104 billion. There's a status quo value of the company, which is the value of the target company run by the existing manager. There's a restructured value, which is what the value of the target company would be if it were run better. And this is synergy value. So there are four basic numbers here. The acquisition price, status quo value, restructured value, synergy value. And here's the way you test to see which motive applies. If the price for the target company is less than the status quo value, it's pure undervaluation. You're not even talking about changing the management of the company. You're seeing the market is going up. If the price for the target company is less than the restructured value, then maybe with control you can claim the difference. But if the price of the target company is less than the restructured value plus the value of synergy, then maybe synergy is the motive for the merger. I know it's abstract, but let me try this on InBev and SAP. Because of the status quo value of SAP Miller, right? So traditional valuation, I took revenues, growth rates, margins, exactly how I value companies. And I came up with the value of 43.7 billion for SAP Miller. But remember they had that consolidated portion of Coors, the Coors Molson, that is worth $12.9 billion. They also had other cross-holdings towards $7.9 billion. So this is a cross-holding company where I value the parent company. So that's just the value of SAP Miller standing alone. That's the value of the Coors joint venture, the value of other holdings and other companies. The combined value that I get for the operating assets is about $64.6 billion. I add cash to subtract out debt, and I subtract out minority interest, reflecting the fact that they have a 58% holding of, you know, of some venture which is consolidated. The value that I get for the equity is $51.5 billion. So it can't be undervaluation because the status quo value, I'm getting $51.5 billion. The stock is trading $75 billion. I could have screwed up. Maybe I should have used a higher growth rate and maybe higher margins, but it's very difficult to argue that SAB Miller was undervalued. So that struck me as not the reason. So I looked at maybe SAB Miller is badly run. Maybe they could be run differently. Here's what SAB Miller looks like. Here's where InBev looks like. You know the number that InBev clearly has an advantage on? They have much higher margins. The overall beverage sector is 19.2%. So SAB Miller is not badly managed relative to the typical company. It just doesn't have the kinds of margins that InBev does. So I said, okay, maybe there's an opening here. Maybe if InBev ran SAB Miller, they could cut costs and maybe not improve to 32%, but to a higher margin than 19.97%. This is one of the things I would do. I almost always do when I see a target company targeted is I look at its margins, how it's run relative to the typical company in the sector. Because nothing else it's going to give me a sense of, is this company a really badly managed, badly run company? Is there potential for improving the company? I think SAB Miller is a well-run company, just not as well-run as InBev. So here's what I did to review the company. The biggest change I made was in margins. I assumed that the margins would shift towards, you know, the margins of AB InBev. And if you do that, the value that I get for, you know, remember I got 51.5 billion is my status quo value. The value that changes is about 56.2 billion. There's a moderate amount of control value, about 4.7 billion, but it's not immense. It doesn't bring me to 75 billion still. So if I'm paying 75 billion because I think SAB Miller is badly run, I'm still on the wrong path. I can't get to 75 billion. So I just value. And so this is not, there's no synergy value here. This is just SAB Miller run differently, run more efficiently. It's worth a little bit more, but it's not getting me close to 75 million. Which brings, so Dave asked, why is the return on invested capital lower than the average? I think it reflects the parts of the world they operate in, you know, which is, you know, parts which are more capital intensive. They have South Africa and Europe. I don't know whether you can improve that, but maybe that opens up the question. Maybe I can make the return on capital higher, but there's not that much room to run. Which brings me to the synergies. So the value synergy, here's what I did. I had to bring InBev into the picture. Remember I said the value synergy, you always have to bring the acquiring company into the game. So I brought InBev in. I value the combined company with the status quo. Basically I said, what if I just combine InBev and SAB Miller? Nothing else happens. And then said, what will the value of the company be with synergy? So see these red numbers? These are the changes that I think can happen because of the combination, because of the merger. The combined firm's margins are about 28% with nothing happening. But if they can cut costs, I think they can improve the margin slightly to 30%. You see, that's not very big. Well, that's about a $2 billion cost cut. I think that's about as big a cost cut as you're going to get, 30% margins. I also assume that the company combined, their returns on capital would be slightly higher and they'd reinvest more. Why? Because they have these plans to grow, sell more Anheuser-Busch in South Africa and more InBev in, more SAB Miller in the US. Higher reinvestment rate, higher return capital, higher growth rate. So basically, I'm going to give them a higher margin and a higher growth rate. So here's what I got as my values. With no synergy built in, the value that I get for the combined firm is about $262 billion. Think of just the value of the two firms standing alone. So basically, I valued InBev, I valued SAB Miller. I combined the two values. That would be the value of my combined firm with no synergy. Then I valued the combined firm with a slightly higher growth rate, slightly higher return on capital. The value that I got was about $277 billion. The difference between those two numbers is my value of synergy. 14.6 billion. Why is the combined firm's return on capital lower than the individual? Let me go back. Where is the combined firm's return on capital? Oh, because they had to raise money to do the investment and push up their book capital. So when they did the acquisition, there was a push up in the invested capital because they had to bring fresh capital in. The combined firm's return on capital decreased. But overall, though, I'm being pretty generous, $14.6 billion in synergy. The terminal growth rate, I don't know, 6% was not the terminal growth rate. This is the growth rate during the high growth phase. I think the terminal growth rate was close to the risk-free rate. I don't even remember what it was. But I'll send you the link to this blog post on the InBev acquisition. Because the bottom line is I'm attaching a fairly high value to synergy. But what's the problem? How much did they pay as a premium? Do you remember? Well, the problem is they paid $29 billion, not quite $50 billion, $29 billion as a premium. So at the end of the post, I said, I know 3G Capital is well regarded, and I regard them well as well, but I think they overpaid. And I truly believe that 3G Capital just had a bad year. They bought Kraft Heinz for more than it was worth, and they paid too much for SAB Miller. So the bottom line in this process is acquisitions can create value, but you have to be very, very, very disciplined. Why? Because think of it as a capital budgeting project multiplied by 100, right? It's so huge as a project that if you make a mistake, that mistake is going to cost you not just for next year, but for the really long term. Some of the greatest companies in history have been brought down to earth by a bad acquisition. And one of my favorite examples is Eastman Kodak. In 1989, Eastman Kodak was a very highly regarded company, amazing company. And then went out and bought this company called Sterling Drugs, a pharmaceutical company claiming to see synergy. What synergy there is between a company that makes cameras and film and a company that makes drugs, I have no idea, unless you figure out a way to deliver the drugs through camera lens or something. But that deal, and this might seem like an overstatement, go back and look at Eastman Kodak's history. That deal sealed the end of Eastman Kodak. Today, all that's left of Eastman Kodak is the name. Companies pretty much the same. So if you look at big companies that do big acquisitions, often it's one big bad acquisition that can make the difference between a great company and a below average company. No, just as a parting thought, one of the things that I found impressive about Apple over the last decade is this is a company that has the largest cash balance in history, right? You know how tempted they must be to spend that money. They can acquire pretty much anybody. And I've seen people advise Apple to buy everybody under the sun, buy Netflix, buy Tesla, buy Disney. And they can if they wanted to. And I've got to give Apple credit. They must have moats around one infinity loop, which is the Apple headquarters, to keep bankers out. Because I'm sure bankers are lined up saying, I've got a target company for you. Do you want to buy this? And Apple has been remarkably disciplined with the amount of cash they have. And I've got to give them credit for that. Because that discipline is what's kept their value intact. Because if they'd gone on a buying binge, I'm convinced that they'd be worth about, you know, they'd be worth about 30% less. That's my gut feeling. So my trigger when I invest in a company, one of the things that leads me to sell stock in a company is the day they announce a big acquisition. Any questions on acquisitions and the process by which we've come to where we are? So let's start at the last slide. Let's talk about value enhancement, okay? And the value control. We kind of talked about it, but in a sense, we're going to use levers you should be comfortable with to actually talk about how do you change the value of a company. We set the table. Up till now, we've done valuation from the outside. You know what I mean by the outside? And we valued companies as investors in the company. In a sense, we're almost helpless, right? So a company is badly managed and badly run, we built in that bad management into the valuation. If a company has a low debt ratio, we built in that low debt ratio. I'm now going to give you a chance to go into the company and change the way a company's run. I don't know how many of you are planning to be consultants or value advisors, but if you're going to be a consultant, this is going to be a job, right? You can be asked to come into a company and say, what should we do to make ourselves a more valuable company? When a company invites you and says, we want to be more valuable, I want you to stop and ask them, do you want to enhance your stock price or do you want to enhance value? You say, what's the difference? I've already talked about the difference between pricing and value, but I'll show you the results of two studies. Brings home in stark terms the difference between trying to enhance value and trying to enhance price. The first study was done in the late 1990s. It was called A Rose by Any Other Name. That was the title of the study. And here's what they did. They looked at companies that changed their names in the late 90s. You see, big deal. Companies change their names all the time. These companies changed their names by adding .com to the end of their names. So basically, they changed nothing about their businesses. They just added .com. Let me ask you a question. If you're a company, let's say you're a steel company, SOS Steel, does adding .com to your name change your intrinsic value? If you're still a steel company, you still have the same bad business, adding a .com changes nothing in your business. Your value shouldn't change, right? But here's what the study found. On the day these companies added .com to the names, remember this is the peak of the .com boom, the stock prices went up, not by a little bit, but 50%, 80%, 100%. Changing their name, increase their, double their stock price. You see, this is easy. Why do we waste so much time in this class talking about cash flows, growth, and risk? Let's just pick a different name for the company. Here's the problem. What the market gives, it can take away. See the second set of pictures? These are from a second study about 6 years later, 2003, 2004, that looked at companies that changed their names. You know what these companies did? They took the .com out of the names. Because now, by now, the market, the .com boom is busted. The attachment of the name .com to your name was almost a kiss of death. Investors wouldn't buy a stock. The company started to take .com out of their names. If you're objective is price enhancement, I have no idea what you need to do to increase your price. Maybe adding .com to your name or saying you're a user-based business can increase your price. So if your focus is on price enhancement, don't call me and I can't tell you because it's completely behavioral, psychological. Do whatever stockholders want you to do and they will. You can push up your price, but that could be by destroying your company. I want to focus on value enhancement. And if you focus on value enhancement, things get a lot more straightforward. There are only four ways in which you can change the value of a company. And as I go through the ways, they're going to sound familiar. The first is to increase your cash flows from existing assets. By doing what? By cutting costs, by being more efficient, by cutting net capex, to increase cash flows from existing assets. Second, increase your value from future growth by either reinvesting more if you're in a good business or actually reinvesting less if you're in a bad business. So you can increase your cash flows from existing assets, try to get more value from growth. Third, you can try to increase your length of your growth period. Remember, we talked about growing at a high rate. Maybe you can grow for a longer period. In an Excel spreadsheet, that's easy to do, right? Make 5 into 10. But for a real company, this means extending your barriers to entry so you can continue to earn more than your cost of capital. Or fourth, you can try to reduce your cost of capital. Increase cash flows, increase growth rate, increase the length of the growth period, or reduce your cost of capital. Every restructuring you see out there has to play out in one of these four areas. So what I'm going to do is take each segment, cash flows, growth rate, length of the growth period, and cost of capital, and talk about some of the actions you can take as a company that could potentially feed into higher value. Let's start with increasing cash flows from existing assets. Here are some of the things you can see companies do to make this happen. And if you've read news stories about restructuring, some of these words are going to be familiar. First is, you can talk about more efficient operations and cost cutting. And if you mean what you say, what I hear is higher margins on the same revenues. That's what cost cutting leads to. Second, if you have businesses that are losing money and you expect them to lose money forever, get rid of them. You see, why would I have gotten rid of them already if they're losing money and I expect them to lose money forever? Because people hate to admit mistakes. That's why when new CEOs come in, they're so willing to shut down bad businesses or divest themselves of bad assets. They have nothing to lose. Third, and this is going to sound mildly unpatriotic or massively unpatriotic, depending on what your definition of patriotic is, but I've never believed it should be the objective of any company. By law, if you can minimize your tax rate, reduce your tax rate, it shows up as higher after-tax operating income and higher cash flows. How do you reduce your tax rate? Maybe by looking at moving your income to lower tax locales if you have that freedom. Transfer pricing. Have you ever worked in transfer pricing? Transfer pricing is within companies with divisions in different parts of the world. Transfer pricing sets costs. So when you're, I'll repeat myself because I think I might have lost you. Transfer pricing basically reflects the cost at which you price things out between divisions of the same company. I know there are lots of noble reasons given for transfer pricing, but here's the biggest one. It's one easy way to reduce your taxes paid. I'm not a great fan of risk management. I think too much of it is done, but to the extent that you can keep your earnings less volatile and pay less in taxes, it might pay off as a lower tax rate. More efficient operations, get rid of businesses that are already no money losing, expect them to lose money forever. Reduce your tax rate. If you overinvested in the past, live off that excess capacity for a while. What does that bring you? It means you can have less CapEx for the next few years while you continue to get depreciation, pushes up your cash flows. And if you're a company with big working capital needs, managing working capital better by managing inventory and having tighter credit standards can pay off as higher cash flows. So you first stop and you look at a company and say, is there something I can do to increase my cash flows from existing assets? That's stop one. Here's the second stop. Can I increase my value from future growth? Well, to answer this question, you've got to tell me what kind of business you're in. If you're in a business where your return on capital is higher than your cost of capital, you're in a good business, you can increase your value by either reinvesting more, and those reinvesting more can take the form of either more projects or acquisitions if you can do them well, or by increasing margins and increasing turnover ratios. Basically, you're trying to grow faster and you're trying to make sure that that higher growth comes with higher value. But here's what you know. If you're in a bad business, your return on capital is less than your cost of capital. You know what your optimal growth rate is? Don't grow. So sometimes to increase value, you should grow faster if you're in a good business. But sometimes to increase value, you've got to grow slow. And here's where marketing comes in. So when people talk about different pricing strategies in marketing, you can either be a price leader versus a volume leader. It's a lot of words thrown around. I think you can actually show the value impact of being a price leader. If you're a price leader, you have higher margins and lower turnover ratios. If you're a volume leader, you have lower margins and higher turnover ratios. Which one is better? It depends on which one you do, which one you can deliver the higher returns on capital. So second stop is creating value from growth. Now, when you think about growing, you're given all these different ways of growing. You can build a new product, you can expand the market, you can go into, you can compete for share in a stable market, or you can do acquisitions. So about a dozen years ago, McKinsey actually did a study where they went into their proprietary database. If you're McKinsey, remember, you have some data that nobody else has from your clients who've been with you for a long time. They asked a very interesting question. What is the payoff from growing with different kinds of strategies? They said, companies are often given this laundry list of you can grow this and this and this and this. What's the best way to grow based on history? So I'll show you what they found. I'm not suggesting this is the end of this discussion, but it's very interesting in terms of what they found. They found that the most value-creating way of growing was to come up with a new product. Like what? Remember, Apple became the most successful company in the world between 2000 and 2010? Think of how they got there. They got there by introducing the iPhone, the iPad, and iTunes. In other words, they came up with new products. You're saying, well, this is great. Let's all go for new products. Well, it might be the highest payoff strategy out there, but it's also the strategy where you have the most crash and burn. People try a new product, it doesn't work out. But on average, new product development is the number one value creator in terms of different growth strategies. The second is expanding an existing market by doing what? By either going into other geographies. So it might be a US-based company that decides to go to Asia, or by finding other uses for your product. Maybe your product was used in a particular role, but now you can find the second place it's used. When aspirin was discovered to be effective against heart attacks, Bayer found a new market for a drug that had been around 100 years. In addition to headaches, you are now taking a baby aspirin every night to prevent those heart attacks, expanding existing market. Third, maintaining a growing share in a growing market. The advantage of a growing market is you can keep your market share at 7%, but if the market itself is growing 20-30% a year, you're going to get growth. This is what Samsung and Apple exploited between 2008 and 2018 in the smartphone business. As people shifted away from flip phones to smartphones, the market itself was growing at double-digit rates. So Apple actually saw its market share shrink over those 10 years, but it still saw growth because the market was growing. And then you get to competing to the two potentially value-destructive ways, or bad ways to grow, at least based on the McKinsey study. One is competing for share in a stable market. They discovered the way to read this graph is $1 million invested in new product development on average creates about $1.75 to $2 million in additional value. $1 million invested in expanding an existing market creates about 0.3 to 0.75 million in additional value. $1 million invested in competing for share in a stable market often has a negative payoff, and the upside is not that much. So why is it so difficult to create value by competing for share in a stable market? Let's say you want to go for a higher market share of a stable market. Why is it so difficult to create value from that strategy? You said margin will go down. Basically, if you have a stable market, you're competing for market share. The way you compete is you cut prices. If you cut prices, your margin goes down. You might get a bigger market share, but at what cost? So competing for share in a stable market, you might get what you set out as your objective, a higher market share, but often you get a lower value. And then McKinsey had its very bottom of the barrel. And this should come as no surprise, especially after what we talked about with acquisitions. According to McKinsey, over the last 50 years, the worst and most value destructive way of growing has been through acquisitions. Add to that negative component we talked about in the context of acquisitions, something else to keep in mind if you have a company that plans to go through acquisitions. So January 2020, I did something I've done for a long time. I looked at the return on capital, cost of capital for every publicly traded company. And I do this just to keep perspective, because I want to get a sense of who's creating value, who's destroying value. This is every publicly traded company, about 44,000 companies in my sample. Let's take the global breakdown. 52% of companies had returns on capital less than their cost of capital. 33% of companies had returns on capital greater than the cost of capital, about 15% had returns on capital close to their cost of capital. So look at that breakdown. I know this is return on capital. It's not a perfect measure of return created, but no matter what its imperfections, you can see that a big chunk of companies around the world have trouble making their cost of capital. So those companies, you know what my advice is on growth? Don't grow, shrink. You'd be worth more as a company shrinking than growing. So when you talk about growth, it's so easy to say higher growth means higher value, but don't jump to that conclusion because it depends on the business. And for a big chunk of the world's businesses, growing has come with value destruction, not value creation. Some ask, what about acquisitions that allow you to grow into a different market? Well, it depends on the price you pay, right? So if you buy a private company to get into a different market and you get it at a good price, I have no problems. You're doing it. But if you pay a premium over the market price to get into a different market, I'm not sure you've done it. It's not value. You might become a bigger company, but not a more valuable one. Any questions on creating value with growth? Dave asked, what about funding growth with debt? So your cost, we'll talk about cost of capital. Now that, so separate the two. If your cost of capital is going down, you don't have to fund growth, right? What if you don't have good investments and you want to bring your cost of capital down by changing your debt ratio? What can you do instead? Dave, want to come back on? Because I won't know. Pablo, I'll get to you. Dave, are you on?
Wait, I'm sorry. Could you repeat the question?
You said that you want to use debt because you're underlevered, I would presume, and that you can make your cost of capital go down?
Yeah.
So let's say that you have a company, you have a company with excess debt capacity and terrible projects. Can you still increase your debt ratio? What would you do with the borrowed money? Obviously, you want to borrow money to get to that correct debt ratio, but your projects are terrible. You don't want to take the projects. What should you do instead with that money? Or what could you do instead?
Not sure, to be honest. Maybe
buy back your own stock. Right? In a sense, then you don't have to take bad projects. You buy back your stock, you get your higher debt ratio, you get your lower cost of capital. So don't link the two. Just because of debt capacity doesn't mean you have to take projects. You can always shrink yourself as a company. Now, Pablo has a good point. He says, well, shrinking your company, make your company less valuable, it will. But along the way, what does shrinking the company do? You pay out cash, so your stockholders are going to collect big dividends and cash flows as you shrink. So your company will get smaller, but your stockholders will get richer. And at the end game for companies is you want to make your owners better off. And the sensible thing for some companies to do is get smaller over time and return more cash to the stockholders. So the stockholders will still have more money from the investment over time if you count those dividends. So now let's talk about the third potential way to create value. And we're getting close to the end. But this is where, this is one of the few parts of the class where I allow corporate strategy to enter my discussion. To me, a good corporate strategy class should be entirely about competitive advantages. Basically, when you talk about a company earning more than its cost of capital and being able to do that for a long period, you're basically either talking about a company's existing competitive advantages or new ones that they can come up with. I'm not a corporate strategist, but I can think of at least four potential competitive advantages in a company. The first is brand name. Remember the Coca-Cola example we talked about? Clearly, brand name gives you a competitive advantage that takes a long time to fail. If you're doing LVMH, brand name. So that's the first competitive advantage. The second is legal protection against competition. What am I talking about? You're selling Amgen. What's their biggest competitive advantage? They have these patents on drugs. Blockbuster drugs that other people cannot produce. Why? Because they're legally protected from competition. You see, this is great. Let me go get legal protection against competition in my company. Be very careful what you wish for. Because sometimes governments, in return for legal protection against competition, take away something very important. The old phone companies in the US were monopolies. They were monopolies because the government gave them the monopoly. But in return for giving them the monopoly, you know what the government also took away? I know most of you are too young to remember, even remember an old time phone company. You know what? But there are still utilities out there which are regulated monopolies, power companies. So in return for being a monopoly, what does the government take away? They take away pricing power. So if you're a power company, you can't set electricity prices at whatever level you want. You got to get approval from the government. So legal protection from competition, careful that you don't lose pricing power in return. The third is switching costs. Now, give you my generic definition of switching costs. You want to make the cost of switching into your product as low as possible. But once people switch into your product, you want to make the cost of switching out as high as possible. Microsoft perfected this game in the early days of their existence, when they started putting together Office and Windows and PowerPoint. They made it very easy to switch in. They said, if you have a Lotus spreadsheet, you can open it with Excel. And because Lotus was so lazy about updating, I remember switching from Lotus to Excel. They made the cost of switching in very easy. But once you switched into the Microsoft system, they made it very difficult to switch out of Office by linking up Office and Windows and PowerPoint. I still remember trying to put a Lotus table into a Word document and the whole document kind of disappeared. It completely went off my screen. And I called Microsoft's helpline and the very helpful person said, are you trying to paste a Lotus table into a Word document? I said, yes. And he said, you could have trouble. And she said, there are two choices. You can either come back to Excel and use Excel, or you can stay with Lotus and find a different word processing program and a different presentation program. I said, that's genius. I had to give them credit. That was switching costs. They made it very difficult for people to switch out. And guess what it did? It destroyed all those standalone word processing companies, WordPerfect, for instance, standalone Excel, the spreadsheet companies. None of them could compete with Microsoft. And finally, if you have cost advantages, you can exploit them. I'll give you my perfect example. Remember Aramco? We talked about it earlier in the class. It costs Aramco $4, $5, $6 a barrel to get oil out of the ground. It costs a typical oil company closer to $20 to $25. There are two ways Aramco can exploit this. One is it can force prices down and drive everybody else out. The only problem is you only so much oil under the ground, and you don't want to sell that oil at $17 a barrel. The other is to keep prices high and make a much bigger margin. The long term, I think Aramco would prefer much higher prices, but in the short term, you can see them using their cost advantage to essentially squeeze almost every other oil producer in the world. So when you look at a company and you see competitive advantages, you want to make sure you isolate the competitive advantage and if possible, augment it. And the last component, this will be the last slide for today, is you can try to reduce their cost of capital. I will talk more about this in the next session, but the most obvious way to reduce your cost of capital is by changing your mix of debt and equity. In every corporate finance class, including mine, we talk about what the right mix of debt and equity is. It's that one that minimizes your cost of capital. But there are three other ways you can also reduce your cost of capital. One is to make your product or service less discretionary. Remember we talked about betas being driven by how discretionary your product was? Try to make your product or service less discretionary, something your customers cannot live without. But there are two others which I think companies underutilize. One of the things I emphasize in my corporate finance class is you have to have the right debt for your company. People say, what do you mean right debt for your company? If your projects are long-term projects, throwing off cash flows in euros, the right debt for you is long-term euro debt. Matching the debt up to your assets reduces your default risk. So if you have companies with mismatched debt, one of the ways you can increase value is by making sure the debt gets matched better. Swaps and derivatives. There are so many choices you have that can reduce that mismatch. And finally, if you have a lot of operating leverage, a lot of fixed costs, it increases your beta. If you can find ways to make your cost structure more flexible, you've reduced beta, you reduced your cost of equity. So ultimately, when people talk about reducing cost of capital, they think in terms of debt ratios, but it's one of four ways in which you can reduce your cost of capital. When we come back on Wednesday, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to take those four tools and I'm going to put them in your tool chest. And I'm going to say, look, I'll come to you with a company and you tell me how you would run this company differently. And it's amazing how everything you see in restructuring can play out in these four dimensions. So I'm going to stop there. And when we start back up on Wednesday, we will do the last stretch of this, of your packet three. And we're getting close to the end. So a reminder again, you know, get your numbers for your project lined up. And if you can please, please go to that Google Shared spreadsheet and enter your numbers. I would appreciate it. Dave, go ahead.
I just want to double check this. Is the final cumulative?
Yes.
Okay.
It'll be cumulative. It's multiple choice. It's 2 hours, 8 questions. Let me take the questions back. I've checked, but it's more questions than you had on the quiz, but it's cumulative, multiple choice. And, but you know what? It has to be cumulative because you think about what we just did. To do this, you have to know how to unlever and relever betas. Everything we've talked about becomes part of acquisition valuation. Now, one thing I want to tell you is because we did acquisition valuation, real options and value enhancement after the quiz, expect more of the quiz to be tilted towards packet three. In other words, it'd be a bigger percentage of your final than you'd have expected to be given how much content there is in there because we haven't put it into any of the quizzes. Jeff asked, can I send practice exam questions? I'll actually send you every final I've given. So that's about all. You have more than enough problems to try things out on. In fact, I'll send it out by tomorrow and you should be getting the review session, review slides, and all past final set solutions. Any other questions? None? Okay, so I am going to end for the day and I will talk to you soon. Take care.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you.
Bye. Take care.